Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and join us now for our Week in Review. Stories this week on fear and silence. An explosive report from the investigation into Boston Police Commissioner Dennis White suggests a blue wall of silence made of some pretty thick concrete.
The idea that you could lead by example and not cooperate when your boss, then the acting mayor, has an investigation that's asking you questions is extraordinary.
While a court battle ensued over the future of the commissioner's job.
The city cannot hire him knowing something and then fire him for the things they knew about.
Lawyers Kay Hodge and Nicholas Carter there for the city and for Dennis White. On Monday, Governor Baker stunned many, announcing the state's doors will fully reopen for business and the COVID fear maybe can lift.
People took the fact that the vaccine was a big part of our way out of this seriously, and that's a big part of why we're talking about this. And rather than relief, what I really feel is gratitude for the way that people in Massachusetts have responded to this.
And a pugnacious local DJ got us talking about our obligations to empathy, kindness, and personal truth after star Demi Lovato announced this.
Over the past year and a half, I've been doing some healing and self-reflective work. And through this work, I've had the revelation that I identify as non-binary. I'll officially be changing my pronouns to they, them. I feel that this best represents the fluidity I feel in my gender expression and allows me to feel most authentic.
We are taking your calls, starting with the Dennis White case and a surprise move this week by the Biden administration to cancel a contract with the Bristol County Sheriff's Department to house detained immigrants. The number is 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. With us this week, Tito Jackson, former Boston City Councilor, mayoral candidate in 2017 and now CEO of Verdant Medical, and Richard Tessay, former Republican leader of the Massachusetts State Senate and a former Republican candidate for Congress. Tito and Richard, welcome to both of you.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you both. So two law enforcement stories from this week, one we've been following lately in Dennis White and a longer term one with Bristol County. Let's start with Dennis White, the controversy over his suspension in the investigation. Listeners, here's the question. Should Dennis White get his day in court, or should Acting Mayor Kim Janey have the right to fire him if she thinks he's a bad match for the city of the Boston? And do you think, as some critics have argued, that Commissioner White has been treated differently as a man of color than he would have been if he were white? Is there discrimination here? Also, should Marty Walsh be held accountable in some way for his role, and how would that happen? Again, 800-423-8255. So, Tito and Richard, I want to start by just asking you what you make of the court case and White's argument that he's not received a fair hearing and the court should file an injunction to keep him in his job until a larger legal process plays out. Richard, what do you think?
Well, I mean, I think you have two things going on. You have a public relations situation, and I think he's clearly lost that, and it's going to affect his ability to lead the department. But then you have a legal, you know, situation unfolding where, you know, these allegations are from 20 plus years ago. He's been a member of the department since then. He's been promoted 5 times. Apparently, you know, there's nothing else on his internal file. He really should have his day in court if, you know, to be able to dispute the allegations and mount a defense. And I think that that's really the question right now. And it's a legal question that's going to be settled by, you know, a review of employment law.
So I want to play a little bit of sound here. First, here is Acting Mayor Kim Janey on the dispute.
In addition to the facts of this case, the investigation revealed a culture of fear and silence within the Boston Police Department. What is often referred to as a blue wall of silence was confirmed by one retired officer who said he received 5 phone calls directing him not to cooperate with this investigation.
Okay, a little bit different angle there. We have a number of quotes from Kim Janey. A little different angle there. That's on the blue wall of silence. But let me still give you the other sound, which is police commissioner's lawyer Nicholas Carter speaking to CBS Boston here.
Acting Mayor Janey's decision is wrong. There is already a Boston police commissioner, and that is Dennis White. Acting Mayor Janey does not have the power to remove him.
So, Tito Jackson, to the extent that the dispute here is about things that happened after the appointment versus before the appointment versus culture in the police department versus Kim Janey's rights, where do you fall down in the middle of all of that? And sort of what's the hierarchy of what should be important here, do you think?
The hierarchy that of what should be important is what is best for the people of the city of Boston. And so the issue at hand is really complicated and convoluted in a lot of ways. I actually come down on the perspective that, one, Mr. White is actually owed a actual hearing. But I believe, any other case, it is up to the discretion and prerogative of the executive leader to make the choice who is actually on the team. Now, I think from a sequential perspective, I think kind of rushing to put in a actual police commissioner, you know, right really at the end of Mayor Walsh's term of service, I think some of that led to not getting this vetting. But I find it not only odd, but really troubling that the police department isn't vetting itself, right? Because they definitely vet us, Richard and Tiziana. And so for them to not be able to vet those inside and understand what is actually being argued from my read of this in terms of, and again, I'm not a lawyer, the cursory read that I saw was they're basically saying, we knew that he didn't live in the city of Boston. He lives in Randolph. You knew about these cases, and you chose him anyway, so he should be able to stay. So they're not, from what I've read, they're not actually arguing whether or not Mayor Janey has the right to do this based on her acting status, which is one of the things that has been bandied back and forth. I also think the culture in the police department relative to the former head of the police union, and by the way, the Boston Police Patrolmen's Association has not spoken to the fact that the former head of their union is allegedly molested children, 2 generations of children. That Patrick to me is deplorable. But also in this case, I think it is really important for people to be able to have confidence in the police department to be able to do their job. So I would say, he deserves a hearing, but I do believe the mayor of the city of Boston has the opportunity and should have the choice as to who should be in that role.
So, Richard, jump in.
I was going to say, I would take what Tito is saying and just head in a little bit of a different direction and say this, that whoever the next mayor is going to be, police reform is going to be a top issue. And I think it would be smart for the acting mayor right now to announce that she's going to hold off on appointing anyone and let whoever is, whether it's her or any of the other challengers, you know, let them appoint their own police commissioner and be able to work hand in hand to reform the department. I think it would be, you know, a good idea. And I think Mayor Walsh made a mistake by, you know, appointing anybody on his way out the door.
Yeah, so let's stay with that for a minute. Yesterday at his hearing, here's White's lawyer, Nicholas Carter, about Mayor Walsh.
It is Dennis White's right while he's still commissioner, when the public is still paying attention, to say to the public, here's what really went on. Mayor Walsh was aware of White's internal affairs record at that time.
So now we know also that Congressman Seth Moulton has caused some waves by suggesting that if former Mayor Marty Walsh, now Labor Secretary, knew and has said that he didn't, which he has reiterated that he's did not know, that that could be a cause for Walsh to resign. And I wonder if the two of you think this is problematic for the now Labor Secretary, Tito.
I don't believe this is where the Labor Secretary wants to be right now or focusing his attention, right? So we have an economy that needs to get back on its feet, and then obviously he's attempting to look forward. But this issue is a nagging issue, and as noted, and Richard and I actually agree here, is the issue here was the rush to put somebody in there, right? So I think that, you know, not vetting, finding out all of the T's and crossing all the T's, dotting the I's, and Rich and I both have been in office. And when you are running for office, one of the things that happens, and they do these things called opposition research, so people go through all your stuff. And, you know, and when you're in office, you know, I had a story about the number of parking tickets I had. I paid them.
Oh, we just lost Tito, I think. Oh, there he is. Tito, we lost you for a second there.
Oh,
I lost you at I paid them all.
I paid all of my parking tickets, is what I was saying. Susie,
okay.
Can you hear me?
Now I got you. You're good to go.
Okay. But I just think this issue of vetting, and you know, I think the Mayor Walsh would obviously note that, you know, this was a mistake to move this individual forward, because it actually distracts from the fact that in several neighborhoods in the city, there's an increase in shootings. And, you know, we need to prepare in particular for the summer post Memorial Day to deal with issues that we often have in terms of spikes of violence. So we have a lot to do in addition to the overarching police reform that we have to do in the city of Boston.
Okay, so before we go to a break, I do want to take a second to shift gears, get a couple thoughts. Here's the quick summary. Sheriff Thomas Hodgson has long been controversial around handling immigrant detainees. Perhaps most famously, in 2017, he offered to send prison labor to the border to help build President Trump's wall. He is an avid supporter of the former president and was found by Attorney General Maura Healey to have violated the civil rights of immigrant detainees during a violent altercation over COVID-19 safety last May. And now the Biden administration has canceled ICE's contract to house immigrant detainees with the Bristol County Sheriff's Office. Sheriff Hodgson, the sheriff there, has said this was a political decision. And he said that it shows that he cares more about protecting the United States than does the Biden administration. Reactions, I want to get a take from each of you. Richard, reactions to this, and are there implications, or is this just, hey, governments issue contracts and then they pull contracts?
Well, I think first, there are a lot of progressive activists who want all ICE detention facilities closed down, and they want ICE abolished. You're right on what you said about the sheriff. He is a lightning rod and he is a target. So it's inevitable, you know, that he would be targeted. And I think that, you know, I watched his press conference today, and he strongly defended his management. He criticized the AG investigation. And what I didn't know, which I found kind of interesting, is that the AG did an investigation of his treatment of some of the detainees, but never called him and allowed him to be questioned to respond. So I think, you know, I do think that there's some politics in it. As you said, he's been very active, you know, and probably a little out of sync with some of the political leadership in Washington and here in the state.
So, Tito, one reaction from you, and then we're going to go to break.
Okay. I find it odd that one of the most political lightning rods in the state is claiming that politics are being played. You know, a Trump supporting an individual who has put immigrants really and treated them as second class citizens, and really in many regards just as slave labor, saying that we would want to send individuals who were incarcerated in the state of Massachusetts to the border to work. So I think I find it absolutely absurd that he would claim that politics are being played when he has been the star quarterback of politics in the state of Massachusetts. I'm glad that we are now taking away his financial, and the part that matters here is these contracts actually pad his budget. And I'm glad to see that those contracts are being taken away from him, and he will have to deal with the budgetary constraints that go along with that.
With us this hour, Tito Jackson, former Boston City Councilor, and Richard Tessay, former Republican leader of the Massachusetts State Senate. We're taking your calls. We talked about a week of fear and silence, and this is about lifting the fear, or is it? On Monday, Governor Baker announced that he would be lifting the remainder of the business pandemic restrictions. How are you feeling about that? Is your fear of COVID gone? Are you excited and optimistic? Are you afraid that these restrictions are being lifted too soon? Share your thoughts. 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So, Richard, were you surprised? Remember that the governor originally had set a potential date of August 1st for the full lifting of these restrictions, and now we're looking at May 29th.
Yeah, I was surprised, actually, and I think a lot of people were. They're certainly surprised. I know a lot of business owners who weren't planning to, you know, to get back in the swing of things until, you know, later in the summer. And here in the legislature right now recognizes that they have a lot of work to do before the state of emergency actually ends on June 15th. There were a lot of laws that were changed in order to navigate the whole COVID crisis pandemic and, you know, and changing the way that government did things in order to accommodate the situation that are going to expire right after the state of emergency ends. So there's going to be a lot of work to do, but I think generally it's a great thing for the state.
So, and I do want to point to Richard's point, in addition to lifting the business restrictions and turning to CDC guidelines for masking across the board, the governor did announce that he would end the state of emergency on June 15th, and there are implications for things like unemployment. Tito, what is your reaction to the timing here?
Yeah, I think we were all surprised, as Richard noted. I do think that the state of Massachusetts has been showing a leadership role in the rollout. And I know there was some stumbling out of the blocks early, but I do want to give props to the folks in my former city council district over at the Reggie Lewis Center, who've been doing amazing work. That's a CIC health center doing vaccination. And a friend of mine, Elena Stinson, a physician, is over there running things, as well as the Boston Black COVID organization. But I think really this is a surprise, but I think it speaks to a lot of the sacrifice and hard work that has been out there. I think the cautionary tale is really around staying vigilant, individuals continuing to get vaccinations, and those individuals who are not vaccinated following the masking policies that are out there. I think we also have to in real time and being dynamic, ensure that if there is a spike, if we do see variants come and things are moving in the wrong direction, that it is important that the governor be willing to put restrictions back in place.
So I want to play a little sound here. This is Tufts Medical Center epidemiologist Dr. Shira Doron speaking to WBUR's Morning Edition this week.
It's my job to worry, so I always worry. However, I think that we're going to do just fine with this reopening plan. Certainly, we know that we have vaccinated a very large proportion of the population. I am comfortable eating outdoors and indoors. I'm comfortable, because of my vaccination status, doing pretty much anything.
So, Richard, to say that, you know, she encapsulates there what seems to be, as we listen to callers and have gone through this over the last couple of weeks with people, this tension between worry, 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 and but I know I'm okay with a vaccine. And I think that bumps up against the question of where we are in our norms of practice versus our public policy mandates right now. So is it okay to lift the mandates but recognize that many people will still be worried even if they are vaccinated and may need a while to be comfortable? How do we think about that different? Yeah, jump in.
I got to say, part of the, you know, surprise in Massachusetts was that really it goes to the national, what happened nationally. And it was, I think, shocking that the CDC in the course of 2 weeks went from the director saying that, you know, she was worried about impending doom to all of a sudden them coming out, you know, and giving different guidance on mask mandates. So, that it is really surprising. And I can't blame people for being a little unsure, given the reversal that took place. And I even think right now with the governor's announcement, which, again, I think is great news, you know, there's still going to be questions. And for those people who, you know, say to follow the science, the mask policy is fine, I think. But, you know, you have to recognize that kids from K through 12 are still required to wear masks. And, you know, if you follow the science, those kids have a better chance of being struck by lightning and dying than dying from COVID. There's still issues here that have to be worked out and comfort levels that need to match what your, you know, expert just said, that once you are vaccinated, you as an adult, you have pretty good protection.
Just want to note, I don't have the data on adolescent lightning strikes, but I do want to note that, in fact, the CDC guidance does have people continue to wear masks in schools. Tito, quickly, please, because then the lines are blowing up, and I want to go to some calls.
But can I just say, I don't want to interrupt, but if you look at the statistics, you know, the kids are the most immune the COVID. So, and that's the point. If you follow the science.
No, I hear you, Richard, but I do also want to emphasize that we've also seen that in the distribution of cases over the last couple of months. Oh, here we go. According to the American Academy of Pediatrics, children were 0.00% to 0.21% of all COVID-19 deaths, and 9 states reported 0 child deaths. So we'll work with that data. Let me come back over to you, Tito.
Yeah, and we're not only talking about deaths. And as someone who had COVID, the issue is not only as a young person in dying. The issue are the symptoms and the long haul aspects of this disease state, which we don't know. We know that we are probably going to be facing the largest influx of quote unquote pre-existing conditions into our healthcare industry. I have a friend who has now, she's a vegetarian, has been one of her whole life, a marathon runner, and she has damage to her kidney post-COVID. I have another friend who had endocarditis, which is the swelling around the bag in the heart. So we're not only talking about the fatality component, but we are also talking about the lingering aspects. And so we do have to stay aware. And then also we need to note that not everyone in a school is a child. And we have some who are elderly who are teaching and are in the mix. So we have to stay with this, pay attention, and be willing to turn on a dime if we have to.
Okay, let me get some calls in here. 800-423-8255. Let's start with Donna in Brockton. Donna, go ahead.
Hi, yes. Along with the points that everybody's been saying about elderly and children, I have an infant and a child, and they go to school and daycare. And so I would like that the guidelines be still in place in those areas, because we don't know how the variants can affect children in the future. Yes, the variants may not be a big impact right now, but that's the point. It's a variant, and those variants could be more relevant towards children and not adults. And so I think that we need to maintain vigilance. Yes, we can be a little bit more free and be outside and things like that, but we do need to protect our children.
I appreciate that, Donna. I also will note that within the last couple of weeks on one of our Ask the Doctors, I did ask an epidemiologist if there was research talking about whether the variants disproportionately affected children. The doctor said that at this point they don't know that in the research, but it is something they're looking at. Let's pick up Casimir in Quincy. Casimir, go ahead.
Yes, hi. Good afternoon. As a working parent, I have 4 children, one of which is 17 and the rest is under 12. I think it's premature for us to be celebrating and the freedom of going out and letting our guards down. I think, and I love the fact that my daughter, who is 6, that the school is continuing with the masking and social distancing until the end of the school year. So, I think it will take all of us to continue to, be mindful that this is not over. This is a fight that will, take all of us to continue to monitor our surroundings and making sure that, that we are wearing our mask in places where it's crowded and keep ourselves and our neighbors safe. It's just I'm fully vaccinated. So is my wife, but our kids are not, and we can't tell who is and who's not. So I think it's premature for us to just go out there and think that the world is safe for us to be, just not being careful.
Taking it back from you there, Casimir, thank you. I want to play a little bit of sound from Governor Baker announcing the May 29th date earlier this week. Here he is.
At that time, the Department of Public Health will issue a public health advisory urging all unvaccinated residents to wear face coverings in most indoor settings. The department will advise all vaccinated residents that it's safe to go back to doing the things we all used to do before this pandemic, consistent with the CDC's new guidance.
So, Richard, a couple things there. The CDC is clear that masks stay on in schools, in many healthcare environments, in congregate living environments. The CDC's guidance also distinguishes between people who are vaccinated and those who are not. That's something that previously Governor Baker had sought to avoid to do. Do you have thoughts or concerns about this distinction between the freedom of movement and for people who are vaccinated versus those who are not?
I'd say it should be more a testing policy than a vaccination policy. And I don't think, anybody should lose their jobs because they don't want to get vaccinated, but they should be required to, show that they have negative tests when it's asked. And I consider myself a civil libertarian. And this whole experience, nobody could ever have predicted that we would be in the space we're in right now, as far as the effects of a pandemic and how that impacts individual freedoms. But, we have to be really careful that we're urging people, we're not forcing people, and that people aren't losing their jobs and livelihoods because they don't want to be vaccinated.
Tito, what about that? And let me just pick up that last thread of what Richard said, because there have been conversations. We had one on air with Attorney General Maura Healey, who argued that public employees, for example, should be required to get vaccinations. We know some private employers are doing so. Brown University announced that in addition to its students being vaccinated, it's going to require its faculty and staff to do so. Where do you come out on this?
I think we are inextricably connected, and the fact is we are as safe as the person who has the least amount of health care and least access to health care. I think this component around vaccinations, I think what you're going to see, and by the way, I agree with this, with travel, what you're probably going to see is individuals being required to have a vaccination. I think the components around, in particular, public employees who are going to be facing the public, I think it is important that be the case. We realize there are a lot of parts of our life and Richard and I have both fought for liberties across the board, but, a red light tells me to stop, and I actually don't get to protest that. Generally, there are things that we as a community have to do with and for one another to ensure that we are safe. I think we're going to have to move to a place where that's the case.
I'd like to grab another call here. We've got Lisa on the line in West Roxbury. Lisa, go ahead.
Hi, thank you. I just wanted to say I work in healthcare. I've been working through most of the pandemic. I'm fully vaccinated, fully believe in the science. My biggest concern with the rollback is that what I don't trust is people who are not vaccinated to do the responsible thing and wear their masks when they should be. I've seen that throughout my community through this whole pandemic, and that actually has me more anxious and nervous than anything. Thank you.
Thanks for that call, Lisa. So in our remaining time in this segment, wait, I think I heard one of you want to say something there.
No, I disagree, Richard, with Lisa. I think she is. You're trusting folks, and you can't trust and verify at the same time.
I appreciate that. So I do want to, in this last little bit, I'm going to shift our gears a little on this part of the conversation. We talked to two restaurant owners this week. They both told us they're excited to fully reopen. And I asked Cheryl Strotter, who's the chef and owner of Soleil and Nubian Square, the vibe that she was most looking forward to or most missing. Here she is.
I miss the communal breaking of bread and just laughing and having a good time over food, the joy and the happiness that people have when they're dining.
So I recognize that we are still in a time of great anxiety, that we are struggling our way through this. There's a lot unknown, and the pandemic is still out there. I also recognize that there are things, as we do reopen, people are looking forward to. And I want to know what that is for the two of you. Richard, what's something you've really missed that maybe after May 29th, you're going to do or experience or take in again?
I didn't take it from what that restaurant owner said. You know, I happened to go to Charleston, South Carolina, and went into a restaurant, and they're a little ahead of us down there, a couple of months ago. And the place, there was a band, there were people, there was chatter, there was, you know, music, there was energy. You know, and I had just had dinner up here, and it felt like I was at a morgue or at a wake. So just having that energy and interaction with people, I think a lot of people are looking forward to getting out and reconnecting.
How about you, Tito?
Well, so I'm sending a lot of love to Cheryl. She's in my old city council district, and her baked haddock is out of this world, so you should go there. But I would say what Richard said, the component, and I think we now, and maybe the universe conspired for this, we really understand how much we mean to each other. For me, who was sitting in a room for 3.5 weeks with a COVID diagnosis, just the thinking initially depression, and but just thinking how much family and friends and loved ones mean to me. One of the things I miss a great deal of, to be honest, I love to dance. You know, getting onto the dance floor and not having to have a mask on. I also do a annual event. I do a turkey fry with my community. We have about 1,200 folks, and I can't wait to be able to do that again and to host people and just to connect with folks and to have some of the most amazing fried turkey that you will ever have.
Still with us, our panelists this week, Richard Tessay, former Republican leader of the Massachusetts State Senate, and Tito Jackson, former Boston City Councilor. Thanks for being with us, both of you. Our last segment is the controversy that boiled over when Matt Siegel, the perennially popular and ludicrously lucrative DJ on Kiss 108, quit on air Wednesday morning and was back on his show Thursday morning. He quit, he says, after getting a call from his bosses telling him to stop talking about star Demi Lovato's announcement that they were non-binary and would be using they-them pronouns. He claimed that pushback, combined with earlier pushback over his anti-Trump rhetoric by his bosses, meant that he couldn't do what he wanted to do. Now, of course, he is back on air. He is making a lot of money, and he's got a ton of free global publicity out of this. We're going to talk about it, but I want to set the terms of the discussion now. We are not actually interested in talking about Matt Siegel, and I want to be clear, we are not going to litigate the legitimacy of they-them pronouns or a non-binary identity. That is off the table. What we want to talk about, what we want to use this for, is to talk about the moment we're in and empathy in our social fabric. What do we owe each other? And why did this story reverberate so deeply and broadly in our community? So listeners, we invite your reflections on that front. And I don't usually do this, but I'm going to jump right in, actually, with a listener call. We've got Kathy on the line in Jamaica Plain. Kathy, go ahead.
Oh, hi, Tiziana and Tito and Richard. I am fans of all of you. I'm not a fan of Maddie in the Morning. I mean, I graduated from high school in 1982 in Wakefield, so Maddie's been around forever. I don't think he's keeping up with the times. I have a 17-year-old transgender son, and I just think him talking about, like, oh, this isn't real, you know, I'm refusing to acknowledge her. I just think it really sends the wrong message. I think I wasted a lot of time thinking that it was just a phase or a fad, and it really isn't and wasn't.
Kathy?
So I think he's sending the wrong
Kathy,
message.
Wait. Yeah. So, Kathy, can I ask you? I'm sorry. I wasn't trying to talk over you. I kept thinking you were done, and then I kept trying to break in there. I do want to ask you, your son, did your son hear Maddie's comments?
No, my kids wouldn't be caught dead listening to Kiss 108, frankly. But he knows about them, yes.
Okay, and what reaction did your son have?
Both my son and my 16-year-old cisgender daughter were just kind of like, this is wrong. He doesn't understand. Demi Lovato is like a real role model for kids. Her body positivity, her talking about her being a victim of sexual abuse, like she's a real role model for young people. So to hear a very older person dismiss her in a way they felt was really, it's a free country. People can say what they want, but it's just tone deaf.
And now I want to remind us, Demi Lovato is asking us to use they and them pronouns. Demi Lovato would refer to themselves as a they. Let me come back now to Richard and to Tito. And so we are in a moment where we are learning again how to show up for each other. Tito, what's your reaction to hearing Kathy? What's your reaction to what happened this week? What are our obligations to empathy and respect and to show up for people the way they're asking us to? And I get it. I'm framing this hard, and I mean to be.
And I want to thank you. And I think that's the opportunity. So I want to thank Kathy for sharing her story the story of her children. I think it's critically important right now. And you said we're learning how to do it again. I think we may not have addressed this issue initially. When I think about how we make folks safe, if a child who is trans, BIPOC, and poor in the United States, if we concentrate on those young people in our public school systems and not public school systems, we would be able to see, I think, a huge change. Those individuals deserve to be respected, deserve to be able to identify the way that they want to be identified, and they also deserve to be respected in terms of their choices. We have to, and also, last piece, Tiziana, doing what you're doing. As a person in power who is able to do this show on a regular basis and set your stage for you to say, by the way, we're not going to talk about, and I'm not going to allow people to drag folks down in this way or in this way. This is where we're going to guide the conversation. That is a powerful use of the platform that you have, and I think it is the way in which all of us should use our own platforms.
And thank you. And I want to note that that was a shared commitment by the entire Radio Boston team. So, Richard,
shout out to Radio Boston.
Thank you. What is at stake here, and what is at issue here, Richard?
I think the obvious issue that we all need to treat each other with respect. I mean, I'm gay and married, so I totally get it. I was one of the original sponsors of the transgender rights bill in the legislature, probably a little ahead of a lot of other folks. But people need to treat each other with respect, and everybody should be treated equally under the law. I think, though, that a lot of this is education, and a lot of it's understanding where other people are coming. And you can certainly question, you set up parameters that, to me, it's kind of hard to talk about, and I don't want to cross them, but I do want to say, a lot of people who aren't politically active or correct, the words that we use and the terminology, some people it seems odd to refer to an individual person in the plural as they or them. It's sort of like this whole debate that we got into talking about birthing people, as opposed to birthing mothers, because, a biological male can't birth a child. So when you're talking to people like that, there are a lot of people who don't understand some of the intricacies of the issue. And the way to change people's attitudes is to talk about it, and is to, that's how we got gay marriage in Massachusetts. It was a lot of talking, a lot of convincing people, and not looking at people who have shared a different opinion and shutting them down. And I think part of the reaction to what happened with the Maddie in the morning is that there are a lot of people out there who feel as though they're going to get shut down if they bring any of these issues up. And
so, you know, Richard,
I didn't listen to him, so I don't know what he said. But I do know that a lot of comedians in general, like Jerry Seinfeld, have talked about how they're actually afraid to do their thing now because, you know, so many people get offended. And you know, I don't know if what he said was appropriate or not appropriate.
So I'm going to take it back from there, Richard, because there's a lot in what you just said. And I want to note right here, you cannot now find the audio from the rant on Wednesday. It was scrubbed off the internet really thoroughly. And in fact, and we'll come back to this in a minute, Siegel then publicly berated a colleague on the air over the fact that iHeartRadio didn't post the Wednesday show. And the colleague did not return to the show today after that happened. And we're going to come back to that in a minute. I want to talk then, Tito and Richard, with the bookends of the things you two just said about this idea of what conversation does a person in power have an obligation to have. So, Tito, you talked about power. Richard, you talked about the importance of engagement in conversation to change hearts and minds. Someone with a tremendous amount of power in our community, is their obligation for how they have that conversation different? And then I'm going to go to a call after either of you is welcome to react to that.
Hell yeah. There is a morality attached to leadership. There is a responsibility attached to leadership. And in particular, as an elder statesperson in radio, it's a big deal. It's not a Howard Stern show. This is a person who many people have looked to and listened to over the course of years, where there is a great success. You know what? There's great responsibility, and so he should be called on this. He should step up and do the right thing and make room, make space for those individuals who too often, by the way. In particular, black trans women are too often killed, literally killed in our society, and their names not heard. And so I think if in this case they wants to be called they and them, Demi Lovato, who, by the way, is very affluent. If Demi Lovato can't do it, what about the young person in a poor neighborhood wherever Massachusetts or wherever United States? And by the way, the other component here is, and I'm headed to an event for Michaela Miller, a 16-year-old from Hopkinton, who the ME is saying potentially committed suicide. The mom and the family do not believe that, but we know that Michaela was from the LGBTQ community, and she deserves to. And we also know that she was assaulted by five youth the night before she went missing and was found dead. These are life or death situations, and not only jokes on radio shows. You have a great deal of responsibility. Step up.
So I want to give Richard a chance to say something else, and then I'm going to say right now, this is an important conversation. I'm going to keep us going, blow through our hubbubs today, and get a couple of calls in as well. Richard, a thought there, and then I want to get some callers in.
I just go back to what I said before. First of all, we should be happy to be living in Massachusetts because politically all of our leaders are very sensitive and provide great leadership when it comes to equality and treating, in human rights and treating everybody as individuals. I also want to say that, another thing that makes us a great country is freedom of speech. And everybody needs to be careful what they do. But, we do have freedom of speech and freedom to think and act as individuals. Aaron, when you don't agree with people, you have to recognize that.
And I want to hold those bookends, too. That is important. It is a foundational principle of our democracy. In this case, we were also talking about a private company, which does operate under different guidelines than a constitutional matter or a government entity. And I want us to be able to keep both of those in our heads. 800-423-8255 is the phone number to call. Donna's on the line from Brockton. Donna, go ahead.
Thank you for taking me again. There's a lot of strong convictions people have about many things, including gender, race, and religion. But one thing remains is that we have to be able to work together and respect each other. And the best way to do that is to change the foundation of the golden rule. Treat people, not treat people how you want, that you want to be treated, but treat people how they want to be treated. Even if that takes an extra 30 seconds to acknowledge someone as they, when you have to reword it in your head. That's all. And
thanks,
I think
Donna.
That makes a big difference.
Thanks. Taking that back. And now we're going to go to Aaron in Methuen. Aaron, go ahead.
Hi. Thank you. I love the previous caller's comment. I'm an elementary school counselor myself, and as a leader in a community, as well as, you know, thinking of politicians, we really have to not just teach empathy and the platinum rule, treating others how they want to be treated, but we have to model it. And it is absolutely a skill that you can teach people to address all these issues, not just the topics, but the underlying ways to do it.
I appreciate both of those calls. I think with our remaining time then, because I appreciate not only how the listeners are engaging with this, but Tito and Richard, the way the two of you are really engaging with this too, I think I'll take your cue. We're talking about public leadership now. And what is the call to action around empathy in this moment, right, for public leaders? Tito, you first. And we got to probably do a little bit of a lightning round on this. Sorry about that. Tito, you first.
What we've seen is that we are inextricably connected, that we matter to each other. And it is time that we turn, as my former boss, Governor Patrick, used to say, to each other and not on each other in these difficult times. In addition, there is an opportunity right now to not go back to how things were. We can be better. We can deal with issues of equity. We can deal with issues of inclusion. And we can love each other in ways that we have not loved each other in the past. And by the way, we now know that we, although sometimes we annoy each other, that we absolutely need each other and that we love and desire to be around each other. So let's do that, and let's do it in a better, brighter, and just more loving way.
And Richard, last 30 seconds to you.
Stop canceling people. Stop going back and looking what people did 5, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, you know, something that they may have said or written or whatever. Take them for who they are today. And try to understand people and understand that people have the ability to grow and change and to be, you know, and to be influenced to think differently. And I would just say that, you know, Martin Luther King had a great vision for the country that, you know, everybody was, you know, created equal and should be judged on their character, you know, and the content of their character. And that's what we should really be thinking of to get put forward and move ahead.
There is our reflection for the weekend from our guests, Richard Tessay, former Republican leader of the Massachusetts State Senate, and Tito Jackson, former Boston City Councilor, now CEO of Verdant Medical. Thanks so much to both of you. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Tiziana.
Nice to see you.